Welcome to the 39th episode of the Board Game OK podcast, a podcast about board games and the hobby of board gaming. Recorded in sunny and a bit windy Helsinki, Finland. Actually, it wasn't windy anymore when I was coming here to the office, but in the morning was a bit windy. Anyway, I'm your host Luis, and with me is my co-host Joonas.
Tervehdys.
Robocon 2026 has come and gone, and we survived it. It was a blast, and now we are here to talk about our experience there. For the first time ever, we both volunteered to run programs at Robocons, and it was a bit busier than normal, but as always, we had time to play some board games around all the role-playing, LARPing, and activities out there. In this first of two Robocon episodes, we're focusing on the games we played at Robocon. Due to our conflicting schedule, we didn't have time to play as much as other times we have played, but we still managed quite a bit of gaming. Because we're talking about several games, we will not be doing any in-depth reviews this time around. Isn't that right, Joonas?
That is right, except I think I will be throwing out star ratings for these games as we go.
You will be throwing out some star ratings for
these games? Yeah, because there's some games that have been talked about in the podcast, but it was before we had the star rating system, and now I'm going to give justice to these games.
All right.
Provide them with stars.
That's great to hear. Yes, and I think there's also some games that we might not want to talk about ever again, and then they also deserve some stars for now. But first, for anyone who hasn't heard of Robocon before, let me give you a quick rundown. Robocon is the largest, according to them, non-commercial role-playing convention in Europe. It is held here in Helsinki, Finland, at Mesukeskus Convention Center. It's a three-day event planned and carried out entirely by gamers for gamers. And this year, it ran just a few weekends ago, from the 24th to the 26th of July. Every year, over 8,000 attendees gather for a week packed with role-playing games, fun, and excitement. Did you think this was
a week? A weekend.
A weekend, sorry. Mm-hmm. I said a week.
Yeah.
A weekend
packed. Well, there is the pre-convention week. So during the week, there is stuff that's happening, but no one goes to those things.
I was tempted to go to a couple of them, but yes, No one goes to those things. Did you think there was more or less people this year than other times, Joonas?
It felt that it was about the same.
Yeah. The event place was having a little bit of refurbishing, so there were some places that normally are available for the convention that were closed.
True.
And new places were kind of created for the event this time around. But yes, it felt about the same. It felt different though.
Ah, did it? Because the square footage seemed to be roughly the same. I didn't notice that the halls had changed until people pointed it out to me. So I just, throughout the convention experience, I felt that, okay, I'm experiencing the same amount of people per square meter as I've usually experienced.
Yeah, that is true.
But you said you had a different type of experience.
It was weird because the first floor, where normally there's a lot of gaming, or at least the last few years there has been the gaming and the board games, was completely blocked out for individual rooms. So they have these enclosed spaces where you would open a door and there would be presentations. And I think you did some gaming in one of those makeup rooms, not makeup, like makeshift rooms. So yeah, that was like the first floor was both busy in the sense that there was people going into these makeshift rooms, but also very empty. Like it felt like if you went to that room where normally you would be the bread and butter of the gaming, that was like not much happening there. And then everything was happening on the second floor, and it was a bit deeper and wider than it normally is, I think.
I think I'm just a bit ambidextrous with my floors.
Yeah.
I didn't care that it wasn't on the first floor. Now it was on the second floor.
Yeah.
I think I had an inkling that, wait, was the gaming always in this hall? It seems like to be the exact same hall, but could it have been one floor lower? But you were sensing dimensions shifting.
Yes, there was definitely this is a different reality type of feeling.
Yeah, volume of this place is different.
Yeah, now we did also the program, and we happened to have like, or at least I happened to be sitting surrounded by tables also playing role-playing games, where in the past I think some of these role-playing games are happening in different rooms, some bigger, some smaller, not all in the same room.
Were you at what was the name of the space where you were at?
It was called Valo.
Uh-huh. Last year I was in the same space playing a tabletop role-playing games. So I think it was nothing out of the ordinary.
Mm.
It was the same exact setup last year as well. Just some of the, I don't know which special tabletop role-playing games get those special rooms for themselves. Yeah. Well, I got a special room for my program.
Yeah.
But more about that in the next episode.
All right. Besides role-playing game and gaming, this event has a variety of events. Also live-action role-playing game, card games, miniature wargaming, miniature painting competition. And there's also lectures, presentations, panel discussions. And I think this year, a lot of interesting English program was happening. I don't know if you managed to catch any of those, but I didn't.
What do you mean by English program? Just like any kind of program organized in English or?
No, I mean like English program presentations, which has not always been the case. I think there has been games in English in the past, but there was a surprising level of presentations and workshops and stuff for game masters or dungeon masters this time around, like to create deals with the devil, to how to manage NPCs, how to break hearts, how to deal with conflict that is not specifically battles and stuff like that. I think in retrospect, I should have been paying much more attention to that. I think it was very interesting where in the past I have mostly ignored it because I'm like, there's never anything super interesting in English.
Yeah.
And this year there was so much, but I just completely ignore it. Also, I didn't have time because of all the program organizing, but
yeah.
But had I prepared more, there could have been two or three in the evening that I would have been interested, but I just didn't manage to attend.
Yeah, I think I glanced over all of this type of presentational program, even though there might have been topics that were interesting to me, but I don't know. I guess I'm just so skeptical about, well, what is going to be the content exactly? Is it just going to be the stuff that I already know about? And now I spent 1 hour from here, which 1 hour by itself is not bad. But in this convention week, if you have a game going on or people are about to start a game, it means that, well, now I can't go to that game because in 30 minutes or in 1 hour, I want to go catch this thing. So,
yeah, that's true. But listen, dreams and nightmares, tips and tricks for horror LARPs. Wouldn't you be interested to check that one out?
I should have checked that one out because I did a horror TTRPG, which I personally felt it didn't go so well from my end. But again, more about that in the next episode.
Yeah. How to role play dead and dying. Like, those seem interesting.
Okay, that's kind of fun. Yeah.
Yeah. Also, this is like thoughts from an end-of-life care provider. So it's like, what? Like, I don't know. Like, I think there was several interesting things there that we don't have time to mention, and we didn't participate anyway. But I think Ropecon is really growing.
Can I say one more thing about the program? So, and this is again a teaser for the next episode. I did one LARP called Benediction, which was set in an abbey, medieval abbey. We were all playing nuns. And people there were discussing about some presentation about the clergy and the Catholic Church in the medieval times. A lot of people from that LARP had apparently gone there to listen in to learn about all types of hierarchies and terms and those kind of things.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So that's cool. Well, what I was about to say is that I think the English program is growing, thankfully. So it's becoming a more international convention, which is very happy for me to see. Mm-hmm. And next time I'll be paying more attention to that.
Yeah. And this time we can say that we contributed towards this friendliness towards our international friends.
Yes. So we can now both not complain because there's more English, but also complain if it was not enough. But I think it's getting to be enough, more than enough, in fact.
Yeah.
Because last year we were complaining about how it's not English friendly enough, right?
Yes.
But now, and we were saying how like, we cannot say anything because we didn't contribute.
But so now we have. We get to criticize Ropecon as much as we want because we did our part.
We did our part, but we don't need to criticize because
we get to criticize the other volunteers.
Yes.
Who did something, but they could have done it better.
They could have done more.
Next year, do more, do better.
Do more, do better. But more on that next episode as well. So without further ado, let's dive into our Ropecon board gaming experience. And we are going to rank this by most enjoyable experience to least enjoyable gaming experience, according to Luis.
Yes.
All right. So first of the games we played, it's Mamma Mia.
Mamma Mia.
Mamma Mia is a very fun card game where you're trying to create pizzas. Each player has 8 different cards with
8 different orders of pizzas that they need to fulfill.
Yeah, instructions or recipes of pizzas or orders of pizzas they need to fulfill. And the way you do it is that people are throwing ingredients in the middle of the table in a single pile.
Uh-huh.
And in your turn, you can put as many ingredients of one type as you want.
Yeah, so I can put in 3 olives.
3 olives. And then immediately you can put your recipe.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Face up. And then this continues until all the cards have been dealt, right? And all the cards have been put in this pile. And then you flip the whole pile over and start drawing ingredients out until a recipe or an order comes out. If when your recipe comes out with the ingredients that have been put in the middle of the table, you're able to complete the recipe, hey, you score that card. You keep it. You have completed your order. If not, because you're missing one ingredient or several ingredients, you have a small chance of providing those ingredients from the little cards that you have in hand.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, you should be paying attention to what's being put in the board in the middle and trying to match that with your orders that you're putting.
Yeah, you're playing a game of memory.
You're playing a game of memory.
Except, I don't know, how well do you think you did in Mamma Mia with keeping count of the different ingredients? What's your strategy with Mamma Mia?
I think I did well enough.
Yeah.
I think I paid attention to the ingredients that we input, but also to what people were putting in a way like, oh, that ingredient is not going to be there anymore. Oh, that card is not going to be made. So therefore, those ingredients that Simone is thinking that are not going to be available anymore for me, they are going to be available. So
exactly.
Yeah. I think I did a good job at calculating which ingredients were there, roughly, not perfectly, of course, and then adapt my strategy and then shoot for the stars. Because how many recipes or orders was I able to do, Jonas?
Oh, you were able to play a perfect game of Mamma Mia, completing all 8 of the recipes. The winner of the game is the player who has completed the most recipes or these orders.
The most recipes, which means that the game expects not everyone to be able to complete all of their orders.
But Luis made 5 pizza normales, one pizza minimale, one pizza bombastica. And then I wonder what was the one more. Is it pizza superiore?
Superiore, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I did all of those.
Mamma mia.
Mamma mia. What did you think about this game, Jonas? Have you played it before?
This was my second play. I had played it with Chilla, knowing very well that the two-player experience is probably not that great. But I just wanted to learn the rules through play and also show it to Chilla, just so it would be kind of easier to teach the game and play it in this, you know, a very relaxed, joking manner that I think the game should be played. Because this game, it's one of these party trick games. You know, you show it to people, especially gamers, as this completely ridiculous, fun little card game. Everyone's going to have a fun time. Although I'm wondering how well will the joke stand the test of time? You know, if we would play with the same group, would it be as fun as the last time? Maybe not, you know. So maybe this is one of those games where you always want to show it to new people.
To new people.
But who knows?
Who knows? I would be willing to play this again a couple of times at least.
Yeah.
But I do wonder, like, how many times will it be fun? That's true.
Yeah.
But I think it's still like, it was a very enjoyable, very fast experience. Perfect game. And very fun. It's up to 5 players, right?
Up to 5 players.
Yeah. We played with 4. Very enjoyable, very fun. An experience full of laughs.
Yes. And if you're playing, well, if you're playing with 5 players or 2 players, try to get in 1 actual Italian to play with you. Because I think Simone added a level to this game with his Italian shouts and celebrations and
that,
curses.
That made it a lot of fun. Also, the fact that one of the ingredients is pineapple, and it was very insulting to his Italian sensibilities.
Yes. And in the beginning, everyone gets their personality ingredient.
Yeah.
I think my personality was mushroom, could it be? No, I think I was jalapeno.
No, you were mushroom.
I was mushroom, for sure. You were olive. Is it so?
Yeah, I was olive.
Oh, yeah.
Purple.
Simone, the Italian, of course, he was pineapple.
Yeah.
His personality was pineapple.
Yeah. What?
Yeah, that's it. That's the joke.
Yeah, he always likes yellow, and it happened to be, like, I think the color of the card.
Yeah, he picked it by color.
Yeah, he picked it by color, and then it happened to be, oh, what's this cheese? No, it's pineapple, Simone. What? No, I don't want this. But he had to play yellow because he's always yellow. Yeah. So that was really fun experience. Do you want to give this a star score?
Sure. But in order to give a proper analysis of the game, of course, we have to consider the historical context of this game. Do you know when this game was released?
I think you said that this was like the third printing of the game or something like that, if I remember correctly. No, I don't know.
1998. So this is a classic. Do you know the designer of the game?
Is it Rainer Knizia?
No, it is Uwe Rosenberg. So Uwe Rosenberg, the guy who does all the farming games, when people start ranking different Uwe Rosenberg games, a lot of people have fun by saying, oh, you know what? My favorite Uwe Rosenberg game is? It's Bonanza.
Yeah.
And that makes them sound very cool because they're going light. Now, wouldn't it be even cooler to say, oh, or your favorite Uwe Rosenberg game is Bonanza? Well, my favorite Uwe Rosenberg game is Mamma Mia.
Mamma Mia.
Yeah. 3 out of 4 stars from me. Just a solid party trick. The reason why I can't give that 4 stars is that I don't know how well this game lasts repeat plays with the same people. There's also a bit of awkwardness in the ingredients or the orders that you're fulfilling. I think it's a little bit difficult to explain the pizza where you put one of your personality ingredients and then 3 ingredients that are the least available on the table when we go through the deck. Now, when you're teaching it, you try to teach the whole thing of like, oh, we're going to flip this over, then we're going to flip the cards, they're going to come out like this. Oh, this recipe, there wasn't enough olives available, so you can't fulfill this recipe. And it's just something that I think it's generally hard to wrap your mind around. You're just going to have to see the game go through the first round to see I understand. Yeah.
Yeah, I think you did really well on that first round. Nobody did that well. Yeah. And they're like, oh, I get it. And I think from second round on, it's like, okay, well, I'll try to put some orders there to see if I make them.
Yeah. And on top of that, teach tend to add this extra layer of like explaining the contracts that or the recipes or the orders that have 3 of the ingredients that are least available at that moment. Mm-hmm. And then, yes, you can play something from your hand as well. It's just tad too much for the lightness of Mamma Mia. But we had no issue learning the rules and playing the game.
No.
But maybe I'm a little bit scared of showing this to my family, just because I don't know if I want to explain Pizza Minimale.
Ah, but maybe you can just do a quick example. Like you can just set up like some cards and be like, blah, 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 Pizza Minimale.
Yeah.
Like just like literally just flip the order. Like this is what's going to happen at the end.
Yeah, exactly.
So that people will be like, why didn't that got built? And I'm like, okay, because you don't have enough ingredients. I think that would have helped because it was indeed confusing at the beginning.
Yeah.
So we'll see. Anyway, that was Mamma Mia by Uwe Rosenberg, all game from 1998. Next up, a game that we played together once and then I played again without you, Jonas. So I played twice in a row this game. It's Rebirth, in particular, Rebirth, the Ireland.
Ireland, yes.
So what do you think about this game, Jonas?
Well, this game has now won Spiel des Jahres.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very, what's the word? Fitting of the times?
Yeah.
Now, there's like another word I'm looking for here.
Timely?
Timely, yes. Yeah. Very timely to play Rebirth at Ropecon.
Mm-hmm.
This fresh Kennerspiel winner. I feel that a lot of people criticized Rebirth for winning Spiel des Jahres.
Mm-hmm.
They said that, oh, this is not even the best tile layer of Rainer Knizia.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's not even a particularly exciting game. There's nothing new about Rebirth. Mm-hmm. Why pick this? Well, I think this is a pretty good pick for Spiel des Jahres. Spiel des Jahres is for German families.
Mm-hmm.
It's not for you, nerd, who is into board game podcasts, ranking different games, ranking Uwe Rosenberg games, thinking if Mamma Mia is a hipster enough pick for your Uwe Rosenberg tier list. No, this is a solid pick from the full Rainer Knizia catalog of tile lay games for family settings. That's my take on Rebirth.
All right. I let you have all that tirade and rant about how this is not for you nerds. I disagree a bit with you. I think this does not deserve the Kennerspiel des Jahres and should not have won it. I think this should have won the Spiel des Jahres.
Yeah.
Because Spiel des Jahres is more like family-oriented games that you can play with everyone, and they can be a bit heavier, but they're for the family. They're not Kinderspiel. But Kennerspiel is supposed to be a bit heavier, right? A bit for the nerds, for the games. Still for families, but a bit
exactly, still a for bit families. Heavier.
And I don't think, at least compared to the past winners, Rebirth feels on that same kind of level of heaviness. It feels more like in the Spiel des Jahres level. So
sure.
that is what I'm like, why did they not put it in the Spiel des Jahres and made him win the Spiel des Jahres instead?
Yeah, it is not very consistent, the categorizations between Spiel des Jahres and games. Yeah, I totally agree with you. If you would take all the Spiel des Jahres, both Kennerspiel and Spiel des Jahres winners from the past 20 years, and you would shuffle them for me, and if I wouldn't remember exactly which game was won which year, I would make a lot of mistakes as I would be trying to guess whether something won the Kennerspiel or Spiel des Jahres. But I wonder where that inconsistency comes from, because I have now here the winners of Spiel des Jahres 2026 in front of me. And the winner of the Spiel des Jahres, the lighter version, all of those are very light games. I'm at least assuming I have not played more Disordered Magic Shop. I have also not played Ditto, but I know it's a light game. And because of this, I think if you would have added Rebirth to that group, you would have kind of pushed out two light games. And on the other hand, which heavier games were robbed from their Spiel des Jahres nomination or Kenner Spiel des Jahres nomination? And I think there is not a game that was robbed of a nomination.
You don't think there's a game that was robbed?
Yeah, what game should have been nominated? Didn't even have to win. Just name a game that should have been nominated for Kennerspiel instead of Rebirth.
Well, I don't know. I haven't thought. I would have to check. We would not prepare for this to be the topic, Jonas.
Yeah, okay. You know what? I have another list in front of me, and this is the 20th annual Golden Geek winners. Basically the same as Spiel des Jahres, as many of these games now only get a German printing. Okay. We got medium game of the years, which probably would be the category where the Kennerspiels could be picked from.
Yeah.
Right. Not heavy game of the year.
No.
Heavy game of the year, you have Galactic Crew, Speakeasy, Luthier. Never too heavy for Kennerspiel.
Yeah.
Medium game of the year, we have the winner, The Lord of the Rings, Fate of the Fellowship. I don't think it's a good pick for Kennerspiel.
Yeah.
It's just too heavy, too long, too co-op-y. I don't know. It's just, it doesn't feel Kennerspiel.
Okay.
It's not a game I would recommend to a hobbyist family. Then we have Moor Colony Bloodbath, which did get a nomination for Spiel des Jahres, Kennerspiel. Moor Colony Bloodbath does not feel like a heavier game compared to Rebirth. It feels that they're in the same pool in terms of heaviness. Right? Then we have Moor Colony Bloodbath was a runner-up for Medium Game of the Year. The last runner-up for Medium Game of the Year is Vantage. Again, Vantage, really, is it even available in German? Maybe it is.
Maybe that's why.
Would you give Vantage as a recommendation for a German family that loves board games? They're looking for like a nice strategy game to play? Maybe. But what game is missing? What game is missing from Kennerspiel des Jahres?
Zenith, maybe.
Zenith?
Zenith, yeah.
Yeah, the two-player game.
It's supposed to be up to four, but it's really a two-player game.
Yeah, exactly. It's really a two-player game. Zenith, I don't think it's more complex than Rebirth, and I have played Zenith.
Yeah.
I think Rebirth might even be a little bit more complex than Zenith. So what is your complaint?
My complaint is that it feels like compared to, and I haven't played Endeavor Deep Sea, but compared to Endeavor Deep Sea, Rebirth sounds way simpler.
Actually, it does. It does. But that's last year, Louis. It's this year's Harvest that we have to...
I know. But like, why didn't they put it? And then maybe they gave Moon Colony Bloodbath the prize or something.
Well, what should they have done? Say like, oh, this year we're not going to give Kennerspiel because there wasn't good enough, heavy enough game for this list.
We don't know.
Well, we can't come up with a better Kennerspiel.
The Druids of Edora.
Okay, that's a good pick. Druids of Edora could have been picked, but I don't know. Did it deserve to be on this list? Yeah, Druids of Edora, definitely heavier than Rebirth. I could see Druids being a Kennerspiel nominee, but I think Rebirth is a better game.
Yeah, all right. Anyway, so it felt very timely, and then we went to a big tangent of
what are we doing here? Are we reviewing a game?
Why it was timely. We played the Ireland map version, in which you have public objectives instead of private objectives. Mm-hmm. And you have these towers instead of these monasteries, where if you put something next to the towers, you get a special power.
Yeah.
A special ability that triggers depending on the tower that you're next to.
Yeah. For example, you can get a special ability of, okay, now you get to draw three tiles. And from those one tiles, you get to choose the one that you're going to pick for next round.
What did you think about the Ireland map?
Superior to the Scotland map. Yeah. With Scotland, I really think my only complaint with Rebirth was that the private objectives seem so luck dependent. And hey, it's crazy for me to say luck dependent because usually I don't mind luck.
Yeah.
But it's just that you have this private objective where you need to surround a specific castle.
Yeah.
And then someone comes there accidentally dilly-dallying and blocking your spots.
Yeah.
It feels less skewed compared to a version of the game where someone knew you have that private objective and then they come there.
Yeah.
You know, that feels nice.
Or there's the public objective there, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And then in the end of the private objectives, when you show the cards, you realize, oh, someone was 30 points ahead.
Yeah.
And we targeted someone else instead.
Yeah. And listen, maybe the Ireland map is the only reason why it made it to the Kennerspiel, because we were discussing it a little bit with the people that we played the second game with, where the Scotland map feels more like a Spiel des Jahres. Like, hey, you are teaching this to younger people, to non-gamers. It's a lighter game. It's a bit more luck dependent, as you say. It has more like, hey, you're going to score some things, and it's less strategy, a little bit more luck involved with the cards that you draw, right?
Sure, sure.
And if you happen to draw very good cards, you might win at the end of the game just by getting two new private objectives, and then, oh, I already completed those. I'm getting a lot of points because of that.
Yeah, it gives you a lot of hope as you're playing. Yeah. If you're, you know, doubting yourself as a gamer, oh, am I going to do well? Or I feel I don't have enough points. But you know that you can always draw a nice private objective and get a lot of points. If you didn't draw a good private objective and someone else did, well, you can play the cards.
Yes. We complained about last time when we were reviewing Revert. Mm-hmm. That it's like, it felt too luck. It felt like, eh. Now, the Ireland map changed that entirely.
Yeah.
And the Ireland map makes the game way more strategic. You're seeing what everybody's trying to achieve. Uh-huh. Instead of having monasteries, which would give you just those private objectives, you have the special powers that people are fighting for, and they're trying to go there in order to activate those special powers, because some of them give you very nice rewards. Some of them give you a lot of points, for example. So definitely feels like maybe the Ireland map was like a little bit more strategic. That's like, oh, it bumped it a little bit too. Oop, now we are Kennerspiel. But it was definitely the superior version, the superior way of playing Rebirth.
Yeah. Having said that, I still think that the lightness of Rebirth stays with the Ireland side. Some people, I know they have a problem with the random tile draw, because in Rebirth, you don't get to see all of your tiles and choose, oh, which one would I like to put here? You just see only one. And this is the tile that you have to put down. It might be the tile that you did not want to get at all.
Yes.
It's like the worst possible tile. And you just have to put it down. To me, that adds a nice lightness to the game where I don't have to stress over all of my decisions all the time.
Yeah.
This is the tile I have to put down. Well, how can I make the most out of it? At Tropicon, there is the board game library available from the Finnish Board Game Society. Mm-hmm. There's Samurai in that collection. And Samurai was, again, available there. We played it last year. I walked past Samurai and I thought that, well, it would be nice to play Samurai again. But, oh man, it's stressful. I'm not feeling for a stressful game at the moment. Mm-hmm. And then when we played Rebirth and when you had picked Rebirth, I was very happy.
Mm.
And I felt that if you had picked both Samurai and Rebirth and asked which one you want to play, I think I would have picked Rebirth. Because at that moment, I wanted something interactive, but something chill.
Yeah.
You know, don't make my heart beat too much.
Yeah. Definitely, it's a little bit lighter. And however, that second time, I was like, my heart was beating a bit harder because I was trying to play it more strategically. Mm-hmm. I also got asked multiple times while explaining the game, the second time in particular, like how many of these tiles we have? So I had to memorize how many of each tiles there is. So then I realized like, oh, it's very easy to know which tiles you still have available.
Ah,
because I think in the Scottish version, you also discard four tiles or something like that, where you don't know for sure. In this version, you know exactly which tiles you're going to play with and that you have available to you.
Yeah.
You also put some tiles aside that you might or might not play based on some of the special powers of the towers.
Yeah.
But you know which ones are there. So if you remember that, plus everything you put, you know which tiles are available and you're going to play all of your tiles in the game, except the ones that you put apart, but you also know which ones are those. So you can make very strategic decisions or know like, okay, this has to be either a farm or a city level 2.
Yeah.
So definitely way more strategic, way more enjoyable, and light enough also to explain it quite fast and play it quite fast.
Yeah. Some people also complain about the constant scoring. You know, you do the piece, you put the tile down, and then you have to do the points. I don't mind that. I think it's a pretty easy thing to do. And I like the score track because then it is very easy to see who should people block maybe a little bit more.
Yeah.
You don't have those annoying conversations about, oh, don't target me. No, I'm not doing that well. Have you not counted the points that other person is having? And I don't mind having those experiences in some games. It's just that when I'm playing Rebirth, I just enjoy the lightness and the chill vibe of it, even though we are blocking each other.
Yeah, you do have to have at least two people that are paying attention to that, because it's easy for some people to forget. I mean, like, do you count my points? And then, especially when you were not there on the second game, I had another person who was paying attention. So even when I kind of missed it, he was like, yeah, I counted your points already, so you don't need to recount them.
Yeah.
So that's the only thing, the only negative about that people can't forget. But besides that, yeah, I don't mind it at all. And same as you, like, you can see who's winning and who should be blocked. Definitely a very enjoyable experience. I really like this game way more by playing the Ireland map. I am ready to give it a 3 out of 4 stars. Now I have come up with a renewed appreciation for this game. How about you, Jonas?
3 out of 4 stars also from me. Why not 4 out of 4 stars? It's still not a game that I am aching to play the next time. It's not that, this game is taking space in my head. I'm just wondering like, how should one play Rebirth?
And it's a game that I would not buy. Or I will not buy. Like, just like, whenever it's available and somebody wants to play it, I'll happily play it.
But same here.
I don't need to go out of my way to to get into the collection. So that was Rebirth, designed by Rainer Knizia. All right, so that was our discussion of both Rebirth and the Kennerspiel des Jahres.
Yes.
Next up, we have Condottiere. Condottiere is a game by Dominic Erhard, Duccio Vitale, and Justin Kempainen.
That's a Finnish brother there.
Yeah,
I don't know if he's Finnish, but Kempainen is a Finnish surname.
But I wonder if he designed this game back in 1995. I think it's probably from a re-implementation or something.
Yeah, I also, I checked the designers as well today. I'm wondering if Dominic Erhard is the only kind of original designer and the other ones have just been added, did some minor development on it or something.
At least Duccio Vitale seems also in the older camp of designers, so he might also be part of the original
design. Are you saying that he looks old?
The picture in his BGG profile looks like an old picture. That's what I'm going to say.
Yeah.
All right. Condottiere, it's a game where you're trying to control areas on a map. The location is important because you're trying to control either 3 adjacent locations or 5 locations in total.
Yeah, just anywhere.
And then you are doing that by fighting with cards that are given to you in each round. And the basic premise of the game is that if you initiate a fight, people can decide to participate on the fight or step out of the fight by passing. And then when you participate, you just play a card and the total of the cards will add up. Whoever has the highest total will win the battle. However, as in any good game design, there are cards that modify, that make bluffing possible, that make retrieving cards after you have played them, that make other players discard cards and that affect other mechanics in the game or other cards' values in the game.
Yeah, you get your basic mercenary cards that go from 1 to 10. If I play an 8 in front of me, it means my strength is 8, which is kind of 8 points for the battle. As in, if Louis plays a 6 and then we both pass, it means 8 versus 6. Hey, 8 is a bigger number than 6, so I win. Except what if Lewis plays a drummer that multiplies all of his mercenary cards? Now he's actually 18. But what if I play a winter card that reduces the value of Lewis's number 6 card to 1, also my card to 1.
Yeah.
And now it's 1 versus 2. Oh no, now I need 2 more points to win over you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then suddenly you're out of cards. And the interesting thing is there can be multiple fights within one round.
And but there then, will be, most likely.
And yeah, there will be most likely. And you only have one hand of cards for the entire round.
Yeah, 10 cards.
So if you overcommit in one fight, then you're out of the game for all of the other fights. So you also need to know when to bluff, when to step away, when to commit. And that happened to me like the very first round. I overcommitted and then I was not really able to win any fights. Even the first one, I was tricked into losing.
Yeah, except of course you do want to win something in the beginning, because between every round, you get those 10 cards, everyone gets 10 cards, but then you also get one card for every battle that you already won.
Oh, yeah.
So even the early victories, you kind of want them.
Yes, that is true.
Yeah, and overcommitting, that part is so fun. Because let's talk about our four-player dynamic, what it looked like. Oftentimes, one person decided that, okay, I'm not going to participate in this fight, I'm not going to do anything. And then maybe one person who started the fight thought that, okay, I might have a chance here. Okay, let me play a number 4.
Oh, yeah,
in front of me, then it ends up the two other players end up really committing forces to this fight. The one starting player realizes that, okay, no, this was not my fight.
Yeah.
This was not my fight. And then you witness this duel between these two other people.
Yeah.
Who both know that they have played way too many cards.
Yeah.
But if they now back down, all of those cards have gone to waste.
Yes.
Yeah. Very fun dynamic.
Sunk cost fallacy.
Mm-hmm.
On display on the table. They were like, now I committed all of this, I cannot lose. Yeah. And then you keep committing and then you end up losing anyway. Now, there is obviously an element of luck if you get really bad cards.
Yeah.
There's not much you can do in the round. And if you get really good cards, you are guaranteed to win at least one battle, I think.
Oh,
at least that's what happened to me.
Yeah, it does feel like that. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's absolutely no way to be like, you can bluff some players and you can try to maneuver your way around to ending the round early, maybe, if you don't have good cards.
Yeah.
But it does affect quite significantly. So that maybe would be my only downside to the Condottiere, where like if you play a game and you don't get really good cards in any of the rounds, you might not have a very good experience.
That might be. I think you still might get to do a little bit of mischief.
Mm-hmm.
And then those players who have those great cards, those two players might end up, or multiple players, not just two, might end up headbutting each other
all
the time and wasting all of their cards, and you might be able to swoop in
and get one win
somewhere. But I get it for sure. If you have a bad hand, well, you're more limited.
Yeah. This is a game that I think Mike Delisio from the Dice Tower has mentioned several times in the past in his top 100 lists. And I think he has praised Condottiere. And that's the first time, if I remember correctly, I heard the name of this game. And I didn't know you had played. I didn't know you knew the game. So I was really happy when you said, we can play this instead. Yeah. So yeah, definitely super enjoyable experience. Really small game. Easy to teach. Easy to play. It's over also in, half an hour? Maybe?
Yeah, it feels like a half an hour game. Now, I had played Condottiere before, but not that much long time before. My first game of Condottiere was in the same month, just a couple of weeks earlier. It was a 6-player game. We were playing games at Simone's house. One of Simone's friends brought in some games, and there was Condottiere, which I had also always just wanted to try, because the game is sold out.
Mm-hmm.
It's from 95.
Yeah.
Classic, as many people say. We played that 6-player game. At 6, it was also amazing. Those same similar dynamics ended up happening, or I guess there might have been more of these 3-person fights. In any case, even if you were out from a battle, it was fun to see people overcommitting and just having to take the hits.
Yeah.
The luck factor, I am kind of at ease with that. It just feels that this is the nature of the game. And you might get a bad hand, you might get a good hand, but nonetheless, you're going to have a fun time watching other people fighting over the areas, even if you don't get to participate that much in a given round.
Okay. And there's apparently a new game of Condottiere coming. out.
Yes, I had prepared this news for you.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, because my whole thing was going to be that, oh, it's out of print. What an amazing game. Give it a star rating.
Okay, we can edit this out.
No. let's keep it. You know what? I will keep the star rating. I will change my mind, possibly. But based on two games, Contra Tierra feels like a 4 out of 4 star game for me. But yes, then I would have gone into this wailing of how it's out of print. You can't get it from anywhere. But Louis, I bring good news to you. CMYK is reprinting Condor Tierra.
And it's on their Magenta line, right?
Yeah. And there's two changes
that are
at least coming to the game. Number one, no more board. But apparently the designer of Condor Tierra, and this is why I had to go check, like, who is the designer of Condor Tierra, which I think might be Dominic Erhard. Mm-hmm. His first envision, like a vision of Condor Tierra or first version of Condor Tierra that never got published, it did not have a map. So I'm feeling confident that this game can still exist without the map.
So it would be just like Wind Fife, I guess.
Probably, but maybe there's some kind of special things happening with the tokens.
Yeah.
Because you could have just different types of tokens and you win 5 of any type of tokens or you win 3 of the similar type of tokens. And I think the dynamics might work equally well compared to a map. So nothing to cry over about. The second change is that it is no longer Condor Tierra. Now it's Hilt, but in capital letters. Mm. This is a millennial cringe for me, because back in 2010s, I, as a millennial, I listened to bands that had these all caps, 2-syllable names or single-syllable names. It just feels, I don't know, bad memories from my 20s from that name. And why did they have to change the name to
Hilt?
Do people not like saying Condor Tierra?
I think people have a hard time saying Condor Tierra.
Yeah.
At least. Anyway, so that's Condor Tierra from 1995 getting re-implemented as Hilt with capital H-I-L-T.
Yeah. I like the art style, though. I know some people don't like it. It's
of Condor Tierra?
Of the new Hilt version, the new art style.
I would prefer the Condor Tierra version as you. Like, I think I like the theme of the fighting and having your troops, because it seems that it's not going to be the same. You just have numbers. So
you have these figures of people with swords and
some figures,
mystical
things. I think not the cards. The numbered cards is just numbers. At least I just saw so it's like, so I think the theme will be more like plastered on rather than
maybe. But then it might be also easier to spot out the special cards. I might appreciate that difference when I'm teaching the game.
Yeah.
Like, oh, number card, that's just a number.
Yeah.
But the special cards, these have special effects.
Yeah.
Whereas now, the mercenaries, they kind of do look like the special cards.
Yes.
The way you tell them apart is like, hey, look at this number. Do you see how there's a shield behind that number?
Yeah.
Look at the framing of the card.
It's gray.
Yellow. It's yellow.
Yellow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Not like this one. Oh, this one has a red number.
Yeah,
that means it's special.
Yes. So you said 3 stars to Condor Tierra?
No,
or you haven't said?
4 stars. 4 or 4 stars based on 2 games, 2 plays. So I reserved the right to change my star rating, but so far, 4 out of 4.
Okay, sorry, I was looking at the new edition while you were saying this. So I should not have been looking at that. I should have been paying attention the way I would have been so surprised that the new edition is coming.
And thank you, CMYK, for printing this game. I'm very happy to buy a copy of Hilt.
H-I-L-A. Next up, we have Tobago.
Tobago.
Jonas, tell us about Tobago.
Yeah, I've been teasing this game in the podcast, right? Was it in my top 10 family games?
Yeah.
I mentioned that I have not played Tobago yet. And Tobago seems like a game that could go into this list.
Mm-hmm.
Was it in the Cottage Collection? I mentioned that, I want a good treasure hunt game for the collection. Tobago is a good choice there, but I have already talked about Tobago, so let's think about Luxor.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now I have played Tobago 3 times, and one of those times was at Ropecon. And I can tell you that you do look for treasure in Tobago.
Mm-hmm.
There are high moments. Is it a family game? What do you think, Luis? Could you teach Tobago to your family?
Yeah.
You could?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think same as Rebirth we were talking about before. Like, I think it's a game where the younger members of the family or the non-hobbyists or the people that maybe are not that into games might not do that well if they're not interested or if they're not into the game for the strategy side.
Mm.
But it's a game that I think they could easily play.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Maybe. I have not played this in a family setting yet. And I think it was one player we discussed whether they would enjoy playing this with their kids.
Mm.
And we were wondering about the deduction aspect mm-hmm. of Tobago. Or is it deduction? Well, let's talk about the mechanic. So you have four types of treasure. You got six different types of terrains. You got these different monuments on the mm-hmm. board. And everything is hexes. So the treasure, let's say the gray treasure, can be on any of those hexes. Except then you can play a clue that says the gray treasure has to be in the jungle.
Yeah.
So everyone knows that, okay, it has to be in the jungle. Now, why do I know that it's in the jungle? I just played a card that says it in the jungle.
I would call it anti-deduction.
Yeah, I'm manifesting.
Yeah, I'm manifesting. Yeah.
The treasure. And then someone adds a card that says, and it's within 2 steps from a palm tree.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're just looking like, okay, well, there's a palm tree there.
Yeah.
So it can only be in three locations. Yeah. And you have little cubes that help you do the deduction. Anti-deduction.
They're manifesting.
Yeah, they show you what are the possible locations, yeah. You know. So that part,
mm-hmm.
we were wondering whether kids are going to get that. Because it could be a bit complex. But we also discussed that it might be one of those fun challenges for kids yeah. where they get to kind of see how piece by piece we get yeah. more information about where yeah. the treasure is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay. You asked me, can you teach this to your family? Yes. Will they have fun playing it? I think so. Will you have fun playing it with just like people that don't understand it? Maybe not.
Uh-huh.
That's a trick. Like if the whoever you're playing it with understands it and is willing to play it and wants to play it, then it will be an enjoyable time. If not, then I think it will be like, okay, you're just going through the motions and pretending to play a board game. So do you know what I mean?
So you're saying that if there would be a person who would not like playing Tobago.
Or if you would have a very young kid that does yeah. not understand the mechanic and would uh-huh. just be like, yeah, this is why. And you're like, no, you're giving the treasure to Jonas.
Ah, you know, like, okay.
And it's like, would... or no, that doesn't make that much sense, but okay. Or like, so it wouldn't be as tactical, as strategic as a real.
Sure, sure. Yeah, although Tobago, even if you play it strategically, once you find a treasure,
yeah,
then the fun starts.
Yes.
Because everyone has been given, well, not everyone, but usually more than one person has been giving out clues where that treasure is. Every time you get give a clue, you get to put one of your colored tokens on the treasure. And let's say you gave 3 clues and someone else gave 2 clues and then one player didn't give any clues, but they were the one who lifted the treasure.
Mm-hmm.
That means they get 1 token there. And then, so what do you have? 3 tokens, 2 tokens, 1 token. I get to see 3 treasure cards that are mm-hmm. going to be in that treasure pile. One player gets to see 2, and the final lifter gets to see 1.
Mm-hmm.
And then we put 1 random treasure card in, and we shuffle it. And then in the order when those when the treasure was lifted and the clues were played, people get to pick whether they want to take that treasure and say, mm-hmm. like, okay, this was my part of the deal.
Mm-hmm.
I'm out.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the coins are, from 2 to 6.
Mm-hmm.
The treasure is always coins. 2 to 6 coins. First card is 4 coins.
Mm-hmm.
So then the first player might be, well, I saw a card that said 3 and 2.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if there's going to be
and more. So better. I'll take these 4.
Or they might be like, yeah, I'll wait for something better.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the fun moment, you know, when people see like how people react. Someone might be saying that, oh, no, there's something better. There's something better. And then they pick a 4, knowing that no, this was
yeah.
as good as it gets.
I only played this game once.
Mm.
Definitely an enjoyable game. I had a lot of fun, especially that part where like you're basically pushing your luck a bit.
Yeah.
Because you don't know if there's going to be also a curse, which would immediately end that area.
The curse. That
or
is,
maybe you know that there's a curse, but you're hoping that it's not going to come first because there's like 6 other cards and you're like, okay, their chances of the curse appearing first are low. So I'm going to hope that it's not that.
Yeah.
So... yeah, it's a very enjoyable game, very simple game. Rainer Knizia is the design.
No. Are you just guessing that every game is made by Rainer Knizia at this
point? I think so. It feels like it's very, how do you say, like...
Do you think that he has made a lot of games? Do you think Reino Kinte has made more than 30 games? Do you think it's possible?
Yeah, no. It felt like it's like, so games that play with probability.
Yeah.
Have like very Reiner Knizia, and this feels like it plays a lot with probability.
Yes.
So that's why I thought it was Reiner Knizia. It felt very Reiner Knizia, which I guess is now either an insult, but probably a compliment for the real designer, which I now check, which is Bruce Allen.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it very much has a Reiner Knizia feel to it, meaning that if you enjoy the antics of Reiner Knizia, I'm pretty sure you will enjoy Tobago. And in general, I would say Tobacco is a treat that you should not deny from yourself. Go out there, experience Tobacco. It's a lot of fun.
So are you saying this is a 4-star game?
You know what? I have now played Tobacco 3 times, not in a family setting yet, but even if it turns out that I will never play this with family, it's still a 4 out of 4-star game for me. Very fun to play with strangers or friends, just because of the mood of the game. First, you're doing this deduction, which is apparently, it's not deduction, manifestation, puzzle, whatever. And then you move to this push your luck game.
Yeah.
So it really feels there's 2 games going on and the mood switch, usually plenty of laughter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would give it a 3-star just because, same as Reverse, it's not a game that I'm like aching to play right now. Or that I feel like, this is like, again, it's a game that if you say like, let's play Tobago, sure. But if you were like, hey, which game should I bring? Oh, please bring Tobago. It's like, I don't think that would be commonly a phrase that I would utter. But I do agree this is a good game and I would be willing to play if you bring it out anytime. Yeah. So 3 stars for me, 4 stars for Jonas. Jonas is being very star-giving right now.
Yeah, I had a great Ropecon.
All right. Next up, we have El Grande. Jonas, you didn't play El Grande with me.
Yeah.
This is so low in the list. El Grande is a fantastic game. We have talked about El Grande here. It's just like, it dragged. It can drag. I remember introducing this game to new players and always the first game drags where the rules even suggest like, hey, just play up to the second scoring. So play 6 rounds of El Grande instead of the whole 9 rounds.
Uh-huh.
I think this is a game that I would really have enjoyed if we ended it at 6 rounds. Mm. Because I think people were taking a lot of time to decide their turns and to decide what they're going to do.
Mm.
And that made it feel a bit annoying.
I don't know,
for lack of a better word.
Yes, it's a game that it doesn't shine when people really, really think what they should be doing. No, you need to kind of just vibe it.
Yeah, just vibe it and go with your gut feeling and be like, hey, this is how we're going to move things.
Yes.
And it should move fast. This is a game that should move fast. Yes, you can think a bit, especially last round or maybe the scoring rounds, think a bit more. But other than that, just go with vibes. Get the feeling. You have 13 cards for 9 rounds. It's not like you have to pick exactly which card. Many cards will give you stuff. So don't overthink it. Play it faster. Play it fun. And if you lose, you lose. Try to win, of course. But if you lose, you lose. Play El Grande without that much analysis paralysis or you're not going to have fun. So that is my experience. El Grande is still a fantastic game. I think it's still a 4-star game for me. Do you want to add anything to this?
No, except that it's been 2 years since I last played El Grande.
Mm.
So I'm in need of an El Grande play. It's a 4 out of 4-star game for me as well. It is in our fantasy collection. Yeah. Shame that you didn't have a good play of it.
Yeah. It wasn't terrible either. It was just a little bit too long.
Yeah.
Which is not what happens normally in my experience, but except if you're showing it to new players.
Yeah. And also it's like when you have had those amazing experiences with a game and then you have that was a good experience, okay experience. It feels worse because you usually expect a little bit better when you start the game.
Yeah. So from 1995, designed by Wolfgang Kramer and Richard Ulrich. So let's move on to the next game on the list, which we have Flip 7. And we're going to pair together in this point.
Hit. Are we not going to say it together?
We were going to say it together. Okay. Next up is Flip 7, and we're going to pair together with
Hit
Flip
Extreme.
7. What?
And we're going to pair it together with Hit Extreme.
Yes, we're going to pair it together with Hit Extreme. All right. Why are we pairing Hit Extreme with Flip 7, Jonas?
Because they have the same mechanic.
Which is?
Draw a card. Don't draw the same card that you already drew. Just draw cards until you want to stop. Say like, okay, I'm going to take these points.
Yeah.
If you draw the same card that you have drawn before, now you bust.
Yes.
Boo-hoo, you just lost your turn.
Yes. What is the main difference between Heat Extreme and Flip 7?
Yeah, so Flip 7, you are going around, mm-hmm. right? I'm asking Lewis, hey, do you wanna hit?
Mm-hmm.
Which is what they say, which is right, they say in Flip 7.
Yeah, I think because you're like hit me, yeah.
Yeah, hit me. I give you a card, and then I go to the next player, and they say, oh, hit mm-hmm. me. And then someone says, no, I stop here.
Yeah.
In Hit Extreme and in Hit, so we have Hit, and then Hit Extreme is the alternative version of Hit with mm-hmm. some special cards. In Hit and in Hit Extreme, one player takes the deck, mm-hmm. and they start drawing from there. They start mm-hmm. hitting themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah. Until the first three cards you can draw safely. Nothing bad happens. But then after that, if you draw the same card, you bust.
Yeah. I think the main difference also is like in Flip 7, you're just hitting and you bust.
Mm-hmm.
In Heat.
Which heat?
Is, sorry. It's Heat. You, if you get the same number and the other people have displayed, uh-huh. because you don't score until the next turn comes.
Yeah, yeah. You have to wait. You don't get to bank those points immediately. Yeah. You have to just wait until it comes to back to your turn. And now you get to put all the cards that you still have in front of you into the bank. But why wouldn't I have all of my cards in front of me, Lewis?
Because if I hit myself with a number that you already have, then I can take that number from you, as many cards as you have, and put them on top of my number without busting. So I can just, if we're playing with multiple people and I draw a seven, then I can take all of the sevens from the table.
Yeah.
Well, a seven is a bad example in Heat because I think you bank that right away, but
yeah.
An eight.
Yeah.
And then I get to pick all of the eights. And if there's three eights, now I have four eights uh-huh. with my eight. However, I have to wait to bank it until the next time my turn comes around. So if somebody else hits an eight, then they will take all of yeah. those four eights from me. I put Flip 7 low because I don't particularly like this game. I have played Flip 7 before, and we actually played Flip 7 with a Vengeance, which is a new version of it,
mm-hmm.
which has different kind of powers, where like you're doing, the powers are just like double this, or then you draw three cards in a row, or mechanics like that.
Yeah.
I think Flip 7 just does not work for me. It's a game that I find absolutely boring. I don't find the enjoyment on it. I have never had fun playing it. I can see the appeal, but I also don't know why, like so many people say, like, oh, this is such a good game. I'm like,
yeah,
it's a game, yes, that we can play, but I would rather not. Whereas Heat and Heat Extreme and Fruit Ninja and all the versions that are out there.
Not Fruit Ninja.
It's not Fruit Ninja?
It's Fruit Fight.
Ah, sorry, Fruit Fight. Fruit Ninja. That's something completely different.
That's another Rainer Knizia game. By the way, is this game designed by Rainer Knizia?
This game is designed by Rainer Knizia.
Yeah. And that's Hit, not Flip 7.
That's Hit. Flip 7 is designed by Eric Olsen.
Mm.
Yeah, Flip 7, even though the games are similar, I don't enjoy. Flip 7 gets a 1 out of 4 stars for me. It's like, don't buy it, don't play it, get something else that is similar if you want to push your luck.
Yeah. Flip 7, it has its crazies or good sides. One thing I like about Flip 7 is that the card distributions are so intuitive compared to Hit or mm-hmm. Hit Extreme. Drawing cards, but I don't remember how many sixes there are in the deck or how many special cards there are. With Flip 7, it's easy to remember. Yeah. There's 1-1, there's 2-2s, 3-3s, all the way to 12s. You know, there's 12-12s.
Yeah.
So if you have a 12 and 11 in front of you, you know that the chances of busting are significantly higher. Whereas mm-hmm. in Hit, when you have 3 and an 8, you might be thinking that, I don't know, I guess I'll draw a card.
Yeah. But I mean, in both games, the cards go away after yeah. you bust. So it's like, you still have, if you want to do well, you have to kind of count cards. So like, oh, there's already 13.
Yeah.
Like, or 12, 13. So there's no way I'm going to bust with this 13 mm-hmm. in Flip 7. Where in Hit, it's the same if you want to do well.
Yeah.
Heat, we played it. I played a game, a version of this called Pelusas, which is a Spanish printing version mm-hmm. of this game, which is basically the same mechanics as normal Heat, not Heat yeah. Extreme. I think the main difference is that you're hitting yourself and it makes it so exciting. People are trying to coerce you, like, come on, draw another
yeah,
card. Draw another card. Come on, you can do it. You can do it. And when you inevitably bust, the people are like, no, but then secretly happy about it. So
yeah.
It's a way more enjoyable experience. I've never not had fun with Pelusas or with Heat Extreme. I have definitely not had fun with Flip 7.
Yeah, I've only played Flip 7 in person just once. And that one time I thought that, okay, I get it. It's easy to teach. It's simple. It's still fun. Push your luck. I wanted to get Hit Extreme because I wanted to see, hey, is Hit better than Flip 7? Because that's, yeah, I heard some people say.
To its credit, Flip 7 is way easier to teach, and maybe it can...
How is it easier to teach?
Well, it's like people get confused in Hit, or like the three. Like the three first ones, sure, are a little, yeah, bit like... So yeah, people sometimes want to grab cards. So, oh, but wait, if you grab those two cards, then you're going to be at your limit and then you're going
to
bust.
Sure, but you could always just not give that advice and then let them learn the strategic depth.
Yes, yes, for okay, sure. And then Flip 7 doesn't have that. It's like you want one card, yes or no. So, but I think personally that Flip 7 is a bad representation of what board games can do. Like... You said, I get it, and I get it too, but I wish this game didn't exist and then people would need to buy Hit or Pelusas or something like that. Like, hey, Flip 7 doesn't exist. It's an easy game, but it's like easily exposing non-gamers to games, but in the wrong way. Yeah. I don't know how to say that. And I know that's very snobby for me to say, but it's just like, it feels that way. It's like, well, no, do not play. Do not play Flip 7, let's just play Pelusas, or let's just play Heat, you know?
Yeah, Flip 7, I'm perfectly fine it being popular. And I, you know what, I am a proponent of super light games, and I think Flip 7 did a lot of good in the hobby in that sense that, hey, now it's okay again to rate on BGG a light game or over 7 or something like that. With Flip 7, yeah, my big gripe is that it's... Whenever you see people playing Flip 7 or enjoying Flip 7, I have to bite my tongue and be like, hey, that's great for you. Yeah. And not go, well,
there's a better
actually, actually, there's a better version of this. You should be playing this instead of that. I played, before we started recording, I played a game of Flip 7 on Board Game Arena just to kind of remind myself, like, oh, what are the different cards that are there?
Yeah.
Flip 7, not only is it less fun when it's happening, everyone's drawing one card, there's no stealing. Because the stealing, I mean, it's so fun. Mm-hmm. When you drew a great line, other people take so much enjoyment as others steal those cards from you. But Flip 7, the special cards, there's the freeze card. It just tells someone like, oh, okay, you don't take any more cards.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, is it that fun?
Yeah.
Then it's there are other cards of like, okay, draw three.
Yeah.
And you give it to someone else.
Yeah.
Which is, well, I guess you give it to someone who has the most points.
Yeah.
Which is like, well, that's not as fun.
I mean, there's a chance of like, oh, giving it to the person who has more chances to bust. And then like,
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, but still, again, like, I get it. If you want to have fun with Flip 7, go have fun. But for me, it's a 1 out of 4 stars.
Yes. So that we can agree with, that Hits are better together than Flip 7, right?
Yes.
But then the big question is, well, you have Hit or Fruit Fight versus Hit Extreme. There is no Fruit Fight Extreme.
Mm.
Which one is better, Hit or Hit Extreme? I've never played Hit. You have played Fruit Fight.
Pelusas.
So which is it? That does not have
the same
cards.
As, no special cards. Just,
so you have
just
experienced
the
kind of like the pureness
of
the game. Which one do you like more?
I've only played Hit Extreme once, but I would play with you and with the group, I would play Hit Extreme every time.
Hmm.
I think with new people, people that don't play games that often, I think I would default to the normal version.
Now, why is that?
And then, because it's simpler, a bit simpler, like you don't have all the extra cards that might add confusion for that first round. And again, you can just play it and just hope that everybody will have fun. But I know for a fact that I played Pelusas with non-gamers, gamers. Everybody has had fun. Nobody has been like, oh, well, I don't get it.
Yeah.
Or like with Hit Extreme, it might be like, oh, this is too confusing for me. Like I can see a non-gamer that is not particularly into games being like, oh, no, this is too much. Like I don't, this is why I don't like board games or something like that.
Yeah.
Or card games. However, if you have a group of non-gamers that have played already Pelusas or Hit, basic version, vanilla version, for sure you can introduce an Extreme and I think it would be interesting. And then they can decide which one they like more. But I think the special cards add interesting mechanics to the game.
Yeah.
That I enjoyed.
And since I have not played the pure Hit, so you have to take my opinion with a grain of salt, I would think that Hit Extreme would go better with the casuals because of those special cards. Those special cards, you don't need to explain them that much in the beginning. You can just kind of like tell them as they come. And then once you play it the first game, people are probably going to say that, okay, hey, let's play again. And now they know all the special cards because those are memorable, the special cards. I feel that the casuals, the families that play games, they want a little bit of that spicy take that in their cards. I know Hit gives you that with the stealing, but these special cards let you do even more fun stuff with people. There's the all-in card, which is basically the flip three card or flip seven. Okay, that's not that much take that. It's like, okay, you draw the all-in card. Now, if you want, you can draw three cards from the deck. And now, if you didn't bust, you get to point, you get to score all of those cards. That doesn't normally happen. You have to wait for your turn normally. Or if you drew any matching cards, now you bust immediately. That's like a really fun card.
Yeah.
And then what else is there? The hold up that lets you steal straight up one number, some numbers from one player. There's the unlucky sevens, minus sevens. If you draw it, you have to take all of those minus sevens.
So actually, there is Pelusa's Revolution, which is the Heat Extreme version of this, with exact same cards, where it's just these fluffy characters instead of a Western theme thing.
Now, someone might be thinking, well, what if I get Heat Extreme? Can I play Heat with Heat Extreme? My understanding is that, well, you can't play the full Heat with Heat Extreme. You will be missing some cards or something like that. But you're probably going to be fine with Heat Extreme. I will give you a word of warning if you enter the world of Heat Extreme. Figure out that rulebook beforehand. Realize that there are a lot of these ambiguities that are not really specified in the rulebook. That's the reason why a lot of people are not enjoying Heat Extreme that much. They try to have a fun, light game with their gamer friends. And now there is this weird edge case that's not specified in the rulebook. I have learned that the way you're going to have most fun with Heat Extreme is just rule all the special cards before any other conditions, before stealing, before busting. Just execute them immediately. Then all of the rules ambiguity will disappear.
Okay. So what's the star rating for Heat Extreme?
3 out of 4. Now, why not 4? Hey, why not 4? Should this be 4? I think this should be 4. Maybe this should be 4 out of 4. Because I cannot come up with like a reason to deduct that 1 star from it.
Yeah, this is a simple game. 4 stars, I think. It's like if you want a party, easy party card game that you're going to have fun, Pelusa's Revolution or Heat Extreme. 100%. 4 stars.
Oh, I just came up with that, a reason to deduct a star. So I'll go back. I will rate Heat Extreme 3 out of 4 stars. Now, the problem with Heat Extreme, also with Flip 7, is that I cannot imagine myself playing it hands like again and again and again. You know, it's just like one of those, like, let's play one round of Heat Extreme. It feels like a nice family game, but when I play with family, I want to sit down and enjoy my time. We're not rushing through games of like, oh, now we have to play Heat Extreme. Okay, now it's done. Let's now play this game. Okay, let's now play this game. It's like, no, we usually want to play this one game again and again. And Heat Extreme, well, I don't know if it provides all the different emotions that a proper family card game should provide. So because of that, 3 out of 4 stars.
Yeah, you're right. 3 out of 4 stars. All right. Next up, Richie Mahjong.
Yeah, Richie Mahjong. You have not ever played Richie Mahjong. Have you ever played any Mahjong games?
No.
Me neither, until I learned how to play Richie Mahjong. I think, is it Mahjong?
Mahjong? I don't know how to pronounce.
Well, now it's, listener, now it's your turn to make fun of me for pronouncing Richie Mahjong very wrongly and trying to pronounce it correctly. So I learned how to play Richie Mahjong at Tropecon. And when I say learned, what I mean that I know how to win with Richie. I have absolutely no idea how the rest of the scoring works. Well, I know how winds score and dragons score, but there's so many scoring things. I don't know. I don't know the full game, but I know enough to enjoy the game. This game, it's so addictive. Those clickety-clackety pieces, whatever. What do you call them?
Tiles?
Tiles, yeah. They're so fun to move around. It's fun to learn how to move the walls that you stack with them. First, because you kind of like, you stack a wall for yourself, then you push it in the middle, because it's always a four-player game.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone makes one wall. So you have this square of those tiles in front of you. And it's, if you try to push the wall, it's like, you can't push it straight. It like starts,
you have
falling
to
apart.
Hold it.
It's not enough to hold. Do you know what you need to do?
No.
You need to move it diagonally forward.
Ah, so you have to like...
like a little bit of this, and then it moves nicely. I played with people who had played Reiichi Mahjong before, so I noticed a big difference with the speed at which they handled their tiles compared to me, who was just kind of like always counting them and being very clumsy with them.
Yeah.
And then someone just going like, and then it's done. Yeah, the tactility, super addictive.
The toy factor, you mean?
Yeah, the toy factor, indeed. And then it's kind of like Rummy, right? You're just trying to collect four sets of three, and the set can be a run of three or three of the same kind.
Yeah.
And then one pair, if you want to try to go for the Reiichi. And that's what you're trying to do. You draw one, you discard one. There's a couple of ways people can take those tiles that you throw on a table, but very special conditions. Those are always fine when they happen. Mm-hmm. And in general, yeah, I can see myself sipping a nice drink and playing Reiichi Mahjong for the whole day.
Okay.
It's not a game I would be bringing to game nights. I think you need the Reiichi Mahjong table.
You need the Reiichi Mahjong table.
Yeah, I don't want to learn the full rules.
Yeah.
But if someone would say like, hey, Johannes, we're going to
play.
We're going to make some nice cocktails. We're going to play Reiichi Mahjong for the whole day. Would you be at all interested? And I would say like, just tell me the time and place and I will be there.
All right. So it seems that this should have been higher on the list because it was so enjoyable experience for you. I just didn't know where to put it. So yeah, this is definitely a game that I can see me enjoying. Like that, this is a game that we would have played with my family probably back in the day if the Reiichi Mahjong was more famous.
Yeah.
Because my grandma, my mom, rest in peace, both of them, they used to love playing card games that are similar, that are like where you're just doing multiple sets of like three of a kind or like some sort of a straight or straight flush. And then they also love to play Rummy. Uh-huh. Rummy Q, I think is the name in English.
The one with the tiles.
The one with the tiles.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So I can see if that description is what I understood, that it would be a very similar game just with chunkier tiles, more tactility. Yeah. So I can definitely see my family enjoying it, and therefore me enjoying this game because of past experiences with this type of game. So
yeah,
sounds interesting.
Yeah. You know what? I went to check Rummikub. I don't know how do you pronounce it. After playing Reiichi Mahjong, thinking like, okay, how much of the Reiichi Mahjong experience will I get from this? Should I introduce my family to Rummikub?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. But that's I did not make any purchase decisions. Let's see. Maybe one day.
Yeah.
I will go find a copy of
Reiichi Mahjong.
Not Reiichi Mahjong, Rummikub.
Rummikub.
And try that. Because Reiichi Mahjong, no way I'm teaching Reiichi Mahjong to anyone.
Okay. So what potential tentative star score would you give to?
Yeah, for Reiichi Mahjong, that's the game I'm not going to give a star rating to because I don't even know how to play the full game.
Yeah, I'll give a platonic 3-star rating.
Okay, platonic 3 stars.
Yes.
Yeah. And what makes those 3 stars so platonic?
I don't know. It just seems interesting. Haven't played it from the description. It sounds like a good game. And we have been giving all of the games some stars. So I think Reiichi Mahjong deserves a star rating, even if it's just platonic and imaginary. So 3 stars for Reiichi Mahjong from me.
Yeah.
All right.
Do you know what platonic means? Is this a joke?
What is platonic? An affectionate relationship or feeling that is purely spiritual, non-sexual. I mean, it's supposed to be a relationship with something, but I equate it with...
Yeah, but this 3 stars... Don't get any funny feelings with these 3 stars.
No, yeah.
They're compassionate, yes, but just in
I
a friendly matter.
Platonic to kind of like non-concrete, non-real. So anyway, I'm using the definition of platonic very liberally here. So anyway, next up, Things in Rings. Jonas, tell us about Things in Rings.
Things in Rings, you have 3 rings in front of you and all the players. All of those rings have a category or a rule which tells you what kind of thing can go into that ring. Mm-hmm. There's one player who knows what the rule is for all of those 3 rings. Other players have these cards that have different things.
Yeah.
Like, for example, a cat. And then a picture of a cat. Mm-hmm. And on your turn, you try to play that card into the correct ring. And yeah, the rings overlap because these categories can overlap.
Yes.
What did we have for our categories?
So the three categories are like about the word itself than about kind of the composition or the structure, what the thing is made of, and then about the use in society. So those are the three categories. So the cards will be something related to the word, something related to the materials of the thing, and then something related to the use of society.
Yeah, I think I think our rules for at least one of those games was like the word has to have 6 to 8 letters. It has to have a standard size.
Yeah.
And it should be found in a school classroom. Yeah. Or school.
It has a standard size. Yeah. So that was the attributes of the thing.
Yeah. So where would you put cat in this context?
It can be found in a school, of course. I think that's the interesting thing that things in rings tell you in the rules is like, hey, if you're not certain, then define a rule for the entirety of that route and then just stick to that rule.
Yeah.
So if you decide that living things come in standard sizes, then all living things should kind of come in standard sizes.
Yeah.
But it really depends. I think some of these cards vary quite a lot from easy to medium to hard level. Mm. Hard level sometimes is like, oh, I have no clue.
Yeah. And then, of course, you have that category of none. I think it's the cat I would put into none. No, it's not something you're going to find in a school.
It doesn't have 6
letters.
Oh, you
want to go for a cat? Go to school. I don't think so.
Did you have standard size?
Standard means that there is some kind of body who have agreed that this is the size that it should be. People should follow this size.
Yes.
And then
so
what?
Cat, no.
Yeah, cat. No.
Yeah, definitely
and
no.
3 letters, it goes to the none.
To the none. See, this is where I think the game struggles a bit, where like you can win the game without even knowing what the categories are. Just like you happen to get 4 cards that are living things and then cat goes in none. Then it's just like, okay, I guess dog goes in none. I guess butterfly goes in none. And then it's just like, there's no way to be like, oh yeah, you're wrong. And then you win the game. Because basically if you put a card in the correct category, then you get to put another card right away. And if you get rid of your 5 cards, you win the game.
Yeah.
I think I had a bit of fun being the guess giver or the the person that is giving the clues. I don't think any of the games where I was trying to guess the word, I had a lot of fun.
Yeah. I didn't get to be the thinger of the ringers.
Yeah.
Meaning giving the clues or telling where does one thing go or was it placed correctly or not. I didn't get to be that person. And I was thinking that I think the only way I can get enjoyment out of this game is I get to be that person. That's the same thing that happens with me and Just One.
Yeah.
I think it's really boring to give the clues. I think it's really fun to figure out the word.
Mm.
But that's not going to be, I'm not going to be a very fun person if every time we play Just One or Things in Rings, I'm going to be like, and I'm the one who's going to put the things in the rings.
Yeah.
And I'm the kind of guy who's going to pick the word. No, I have to also then sometimes write the clue.
Yeah, and surprisingly,
I'd be bored out of my mind.
Surprisingly, this is not a game that goes that fast. Like your people are still thinking, like, where should I put this? What does it mean?
Yeah,
and it's really hard. It's like many of the clues, especially if they're harder or medium, like it's really hard to define these lines of like where does this go?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. And we tried it cooperatively. I think cooperatively would have been fun
if
Nico, who owns the game, would not have known all of the cards that came already in the game. And then we're like, oh, yeah, I think that's the rule. I'm like, okay, we're playing cooperatively. But then it defeated the purpose, which is like you're trying to then guess the clues, which I think would have been fun to play with somebody that doesn't know all of the cards.
Could be, yeah. Back in the day when Things in Rings came out, not so long time ago.
No.
I was really tempted to get it because the premise spoke to me.
Yeah.
What is that game? Is it called 20 Questions? Where you have to guess the thing I'm thinking about.
Mm-hmm.
I actually think it's pretty okay. Okay way to pass time in a car.
Yeah.
You know, when you have like a road trip or something.
Definitely.
And I don't need to know the word. I can be also the guesser.
Yeah.
Because in the end, there is a sweet satisfaction of realizing like, oh, it was the hair of the bear that bit Goldilocks or something like that. Whereas in this game, you don't end up knowing what the categories are.
Yes.
Maybe for the word, that's easy to figure out. But the other ones, you don't even know it. And then in the end, it's like, oh, it was that. Well,
yeah. So then that's where the rules, I think this game is done a disservice by its own rules. Nico was saying how the first time they played, you don't get to play immediately another card in your turn if you guess correctly. Like everybody, just the turns just pass. Like, so if you guess correctly, you just get rid of one card. But then the turns pass. So then more people get to play. So then maybe more cards get to place in different way, in different places where like then you maybe get to guess the what the categories are. And yeah. I think that's the fun part. Like, hey, you're trying to figure out what the rules are or what the categories are. But in most of the games that I played, we never knew, like, if there was one hard card, we never knew what the thing was.
Yeah.
Exactly. And that defeated the purpose. And it's like, if there was other rules or if we were playing cooperative with somebody that doesn't know the cards, maybe we could have gotten to this, like, ah, yeah, we figure it out. Yay! Moment, which didn't happen. And that, for me, was not a good experience and therefore not a good game.
Yeah, but I only played it now twice, so I don't know.
I played it like 7 times or 8.
Yeah, but I don't have an issue with someone like rushing the game, but I get what you mean that, okay, well, what if you don't rush the game? If you end up playing more cards, will you get more information? But I have heard other people also saying that, well, you're just going to end up vibing it, which I can see even with more cards, you kind of just vibe it. Mm-hmm. Well, we got a lot of animals here, so maybe something animally there. And then you see that, oh, it was, I don't know, things with paws. That's a really bad example.
Yeah.
And again, I don't get to solve the puzzle.
Yeah.
I just get to kind of feel like, okay, it might be this, but I want to solve their riddle.
Yeah. And I don't think you get to do it like many times. You're like, you have to vibe it because, okay, I think this is here because there might be something related to this.
Yeah.
And then sometimes you're right, but then there was always one category where we're like, yeah, that was the hard card. We never figure out what could possibly be the category. Yeah, so I do agree. If somehow you could manage to guess what the categories were within the limits of the game, every single game, or at least the majority of the games, I think my opinion of the game would be different. But because of that, to me, this is a 1 or 4 stars game. The premise sounds right, sounds cool. The premise looks cool. Even the first time you start playing the game, like, oh.
Yeah.
And if you played maybe with all simple cards or very easy cards, then maybe you would get this. But then eventually you would probably get bored or get to learn all of the cards. So,
Yeah, 1 out of 4 stars also for me.
Yeah.
A bit of a disappointment.
Yeah. Even by being the thinger in the ringer.
No, I didn't get to. I did not get to be.
No, but I say, I got to be. Yeah, I got to be a couple of times.
You can say this as a thinger in the ringer.
In the ringer.
1 out of 4 stars.
1 of 4 stars. And last in our games that we played in Ropecon, we have Aquatica Duellum.
Oh, no, Indonesia talk.
Well, if you want to talk about Indonesia, we can keep it as a like a separate section because it's not in the list.
What do you mean? Because you, why didn't you put it on the list? I told you, you guess how good of an experience I had with Indonesia.
I didn't. It would have gone in a different place. So this is going to be a special mention.
Okay.
Aquatica Duellum.
Okay, so we're going to go to Aquatica Duellum.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I don't think you had a terrible experience with Indonesia. So it would have been higher on the list.
It would have been higher.
So this is going to be a special mention. So Aquatica Duellum is a game that we had, or that I personally put in the lowest rank of this list, even lower than Things in Rings.
Yeah, I think that's where it belongs.
Yeah. I had some good expectations of the game, even though it was bought just through miscommunication.
Yeah. I always wanted to get Aquarium?
Aquaria. From Tomasz Holek, designer of SETI. And I said to somebody, hey, can you buy me Aquatica? And then they found Aquatica Duellum and they bought me Aquatica Duellum.
Yeah.
However, I had heard good things about Aquatica. I've never played it.
Same here.
The game looks really nice. It has a really nice production.
Yes.
It sounds interesting.
Yeah.
However, when we played it, what happened, Jonas?
Well, first of all, we played 2 games in 3 hours.
Yeah.
Well, we had to teach, a little bit teach went into it. I would say roughly 3 hours for those 2 games. For this tug of war dueler.
Yeah.
We now have so many duels. We have Azul Duel. We already had Seven Wonders Duel. Now we have Azul Duel. We have Everdell Duel. We got
Splendor.
Splendor Duel. We got White Castle Duel. Mm-hmm. A lot of duels. This one, Aquatica Duellum, it's just another soulless duel, I would say.
Which none of the other ones that you have mentioned have been a soulless
duel. Well, I have not tried many.
You have not tried, okay. Yeah.
Seven Wonders Duel, I would say it is not a soulless duel.
Yeah.
And I think that the comparisons between Aquatica Duellum and Seven Wonders Duel are fair in my field, in my opinion. Is it, how many victory conditions do you have in Seven Wonders Duel?
Three.
Yeah. Here you have also three or four, but it's three. The same kind of feeling of like, okay, you have this one tug of war board.
Yeah.
Well, now you can go also sideways a little bit, so you don't always go back and forth. Wow, very exciting. And then you have this like, okay, achieve all of these things and you can win that way. You can count points. And then science victory, that's in Seven Wonders Duel. Here it would be the...
I think it would be the track.
The king's crown track, or whatever. Yeah, yeah. But picking the cards is really boring. And everything else is kind of boring as well.
Yeah. So we said when we were discussing the game, I think it has an interesting premise, but a bad execution. Similarly to Thinking Ring, where hey, the idea of what they were trying to do, where like, hey, you're buying cards with pearls or with coins, and I'm buying with tridents, and then the one that is most expensive to you is the cheapest to me. And then you can like rotate the pricing of the cards.
Yeah, so I'm laughing because I listened to the Gen Con preview episode where you mentioned Aquatica Duelum, said that, okay, this is not something you want to check out. It has interesting things, but they're not well put together.
Yeah.
My take is the exact opposite of yours.
Yeah.
I think it has a lot of boring things that are functionally working together.
Yeah, no. The thing, like, I don't think they're supposed to be boring. And I think maybe we're saying the same thing. Where I think the fact that they're not well put together is what makes them boring.
Yeah.
Because if they had managed to make it interesting, then they would be like, oh, this works, where it doesn't. But yes, I can see that, like, many of the things are, because they're not well put together, they can be perceived as boring.
Yeah.
I'll give you that.
Yeah. And I remember you saying that, well, Jonas, at least this is a little bit compotastic. So you get to have a little bit of combos. Let me give you, dear listener, an example of the compotasticness of the game. I need to pay 6 money for this location card. I have only 2 money. But wait, I'll use one of my existing locations to get 2 money. And then I flip one of my animals to get 2 more money. Now I have 6 money. Combos, combos, combos.
Yeah, and then you cannot use your animal until you refresh it.
Yeah, like it's compotastic in the sense that, yeah, you need to find out under which couch pillow did you, where is your change exactly. That's not really fun for me to figure out, like, where do I get the 2 money? Oh, yeah, it's this animal here. I flipped this. Okay, now I have 2 money. Now I can buy this.
Yeah, but again, like the idea that you're like moving locations because you're exploring them, and then sometimes you get restricted because like, oh, you cannot move it because it's an empty circle. Like then you have to find a way to move it through different cards or different things.
Sure. That's,
again, so, but again, like it does not work. Like the idea of that is cool. The idea of having different pricing is cool, but it just doesn't work. The idea it's not fun. Like again, like I think it's just like, oh, well, it's either too easy because like, oh, boop, I flip an animal. I just explore the location that was blocking me.
Yeah.
Also like there's the card that like, oh, now I force you to explore some locations that you could have gotten some nice bennies from or some nice benefits. But you're like, okay, then I buy this other card which also has the same benefits.
Yeah.
You know, like, again, like, I think there's some interesting ideas badly executed. They don't work.
Yeah, or even that, like, that mercenary that does this thing where you have to explore the thing, it's like, oh, no. So now we play 10 more minutes this game because...
Yeah. I think I want to play it one more time. Just to see if
there is life under the sea.
Yeah, life on the sea. If like finding the change under the sofa, like, oh, I found some change.
Yeah,
I don't know. Maybe I shouldn't waste my time. Interesting game.
Well, your words.
Interesting looking
not
game.
Mine.
Interesting ideas, badly executed, badly play tested, in my opinion. Like not coming together very well, according to Jonas. Good execution, but boring ideas. That's what you said, right?
Yeah. And I guess we're being very harsh.
We're being harsh, but it's like, again, like, if there was no dual games, if there was no two-player games in the market, it's like, hey, maybe get it. There's so many options.
Yeah.
So many things where like, hey, don't waste your time. Now, because of Aquatica being so well-regarded, because of some of the mechanisms here that I find maybe are interesting, maybe they're there and they work well there. So now I'm interested on playing that. Obviously, you might not have the rotation device that change the price. But like, I'm like, now I'm looking forward to Chain Aquatica, which I haven't yet done or seen or even read the rules or even seen pictures of the game. But I feel interested of it. But definitely, Aquatica Duellum is a 1 out of 4 stars for me.
Same here, 1 out of 4 stars. And with the harshness, it's, well, I don't know the motives behind this game, but it does feel that, hey, Aquatica, very popular game, well-regarded. They give the task for the designer to say, like, okay, make a dual version of it.
Yeah.
And it just feels like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Poor Ivan Tusovsky. Mm. But also designer of Aquatica, which we hope it's a good game. And well-rewarded. 575 rank in Board Game Geek, Aquatica, not Duellum. All right, so that was the official list.
Okay.
So now we'll get to the honorable mention.
Yeah, an honorable mention, a game Lewis did not get to participate because he was game mastering at that time.
Betrayal.
We played Indonesia, which was on my most expected games for this year. Yes, it's an older game, but now there's a new version that's actually playable with all the usability improvements. Which I actually don't know what the usability improvements are, but I can tell you that Indonesia, even with this third version, it's a beast with the bookkeeping. And oh Lord, if it has been worse at some moment in history, yes, I can totally see a lot of people feeling that, I want to love this game, but why is it made like this? Okay, of course, this is a game I want to play with you, absolutely, and I want to talk more about it in the podcast to a proper review. But let me now not bury the lead. This is a really special game. It's a really special game. Really, the only big problem in Indonesia is the physical toll it takes. I think our game took more than 5 hours, teach included. Oof. And the final rounds were horrible from the bookkeeping perspective, especially this convention setting where there's a lot of other noises.
Yeah. People coming and checking out, distracting you.
I had not had a warm meal in 24 hours more than that. Yeah. Is that the ideal circumstance? Although, maybe it was because, you know, in conventions, people are willing to tolerate all kinds of unpleasantness and willing to kind of like put in the extra effort. Hey, I had tried Indonesia twice online before we played it in real life at Ropecon. And playing the game online really didn't give me much strategic understanding of the game. As in, like, I didn't really understand always what's happening as the turns are taken asynchronously. The computer does the calculations for you. But after this Ropecon play, I started a third game online, and now I see the game, and I'm waiting patiently for my next move.
Where are you playing this one?
Is it called onlineboardgamers.com?
Okay.
Has a lot of Splotter games. Indonesia is a Splotter game. And hey, just last thing I will say about Indonesia. What's the pitch for Indonesia? Well, do you like the idea of acquiring and merging companies? If you do, there's a very high chance that Indonesia is for you, even if it lasts for a very long time and even if there's a lot of bookkeeping. It's all worth it.
All right. No star rating for Indonesia because it's an honorable mention.
Yeah.
All right. So that's the first part of our Ropecon experience, the games that we played. We want to thank you for your time. Our next episode is airing in about 2 weeks. In the meantime, you can visit boardgameok.com for more information about the show.
Moi, moi.